Today is Friday, October the 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. President Joe Biden told visiting Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on Thursday that the United States will make a one-time donation of more than $17 million of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to the African Union. And even though Congress voted this week to raise the debt ceiling, the political battles around this issue will likely continue in December of this year. But has it always been like this?
That's the worry of experts, economists, political scientists, people who observe this, is the brinkmanship around the debt ceiling keeps getting more and more of a high-stake game.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that time was running out for Iran to return to negotiations in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal.
We will look at every option to deal with the challenge posed by Iran. We continue to believe that diplomacy is the most effective way to do that, but it takes two to engage in diplomacy, and we have not seen from Iran a willingness to do that.
And a panel of expert advisors to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration unanimously voted on Thursday to recommend booster shots of Moderna COVID-19 vaccine for Americans aged 65 and older and those at high risk of severe illness. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, President Joe Biden is praising efforts to push back against misinformation about COVID-19 vaccination mandates. AP correspondent Saga Meghani reports.
Each day, the president says more employers are adding vaccination requirements for their workers.
And the mounting data shows that they work.
He says it should not be another issue that divides Americans, but it is.
That's why we continue to battle the misinformation that's out there.
Noting Southwest Airlines and its pilots union rejected claims that days of flight delays were caused by workers protesting the airline's pending vaccine mandate. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
President Biden will meet with Pope Francis at the Vatican later this month during a trip to Europe for two high-profile global summits. The White House says that Biden and Pope Francis will discuss working together on efforts grounded in respect for fundamental human dignity, including ending the COVID-19 pandemic, tackling the climate crisis, and caring for the poor. AP Saga Meghani joins us again with this report.
President Biden will meet with Pope Francis later this month. The president will start a five-day trip through Italy and the UK in Vatican City. The White House says he and the Pope will talk about the virus pandemic, climate crisis, and poverty. The president's Roman Catholic and attends Mass every weekend, but some Catholic leaders have criticized his backing of gay marriage and abortion rights, and a number of bishops this year debated denying him communion, but eventually backed off. The president will later head to a G20 summit in Rome and then a UN climate conference in Scotland. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that time was running out for Iran to return to negotiations in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, and that the United States was prepared to consider other options if Iran refused to negotiate in good faith. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Iran was the focus of talks Wednesday at the State Department between Secretary of State Antony Blinken and his counterparts from Israel and the United Arab Emirates. Blinken said that for the past 9 months, the Biden administration has made clear the U.S. would return to full compliance with the Iran nuclear deal if Iran did the same. Now, he says, time is running out. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
I'm not going to put a specific date on it, but with every passing day and Iran's refusal to engage in good faith, the runway gets short.
Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid painted a grimmer picture, saying Iran is on the threshold of acquiring nuclear weapons. Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid.
If the Iranians don't believe the world is serious about stopping them, they'll race to the bomb. Israel reserves the right to act at any given moment in any way.
Blinken said the U.S. still believes the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is the most effective way to deal with the challenge posed by Iran. But the U.S. is prepared to consider other options if Iran refuses to negotiate. Lapid said those other options were at the core of their talks Wednesday. For months, the U.S., along with other major powers, has sought to salvage the 2015 deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, through a series of indirect talks in Vienna, Austria. But those talks have stalled, and some observers say prospects look even dimmer with the new leadership in Tehran. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran's nuclear program is peaceful, and he has slammed U.S. sanctions on Tehran as a new way of waging war. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. This week, Congress voted to temporarily raise the debt ceiling, pushing off the deadline for debt default to December. However, following what is widely viewed as a short-term fix, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell sent a letter to President Biden warning that his caucus would not assist Democrats with raising the debt limit in the future. Senator McConnell had earlier insisted that Democrats had the ability to hike the debt ceiling without the help of Republicans. But has this process to lift the debt ceiling always been this thorny political issue, or is it a product of a polarized political environment? Dr. William Hatcher is the interim chair of the Department of Social Sciences and an associate professor of political science at Augusta University in Georgia. He joins me in the second part of our conversation to explain the recent history of the political brinkmanship that has become a hallmark of Washington politics.
That brinkmanship keeps getting worse and worse. We saw it go up in 2011 with the Barack Obama administration and the Republicans in Congress then. In 2013, it took it to another step. During the Barack Obama administration, you had a couple shutdowns of government over the debt ceiling. You had a period of calm, mostly through a good bit of the Trump administration, because the Republicans controlled Congress through a good bit of his administration, and the debt ceiling was extended. Not to be partisan about this, but historically in the recent years, the brinkmanship has been pushed more by Republicans. And the years that has been pushed more by Republicans, 2011, 2013, and now, it keeps getting more and more intense and more and more high-stakes political game.
Right. Now, Senator Mitch McConnell says that Democrats could have done this through a budget reconciliation process without the help of Republicans. Why didn't Senator Schumer go that route?
That's correct. They could. But from the Democrats' perspective, that labels them as completely owning the debt, that they're increasing the debt limit, when from their argument is debt that both parties have accumulated over time. You know, that's one of the confusion. I mean, all this to a certain degree is confusing when you start getting into the federal budget, economics, debt, and how debt at the federal budget's different than state and local government debt in the United States, different than household debt. But it's a debt that both parties have accumulated over time. And that's the Democrats' perspective on this. The Republican Party is acting in many ways, to get back to, they're the party out of power right now. So they're using that debt ceiling as an opportunity to make the party in power own that bad political decision.
Okay. Now, how does this impact other negotiations that are taking place on the Hill as President Biden tries to move forward with his domestic agenda?
You know, our political system in the United States, it is so difficult to get anything done. It's amazing that things do get done, especially in the era of political polarization where both sides are so hardened in their views. The debt ceiling, another reason the brinkmanship is getting more intense over the last decade and what we're going through right now, is because it's one of those periods, one of those tools in the political system right now that can be used to open a window to get other decisions done, to get other agreement, because it's something they have to decide on by a certain amount of time. And you see the same thing too, even though it's related with the funding of the government. You see these brinkmanship decisions around the funding of the federal government, because those are decisions that have to be made by a certain time frame, and it can push parties to come together on other decisions. But it has an effect on the ability of the Democratic Party to put in place and pass President Biden's policy agenda, which is really, really ambitious. A large package on infrastructure, a large package on a number of social programs, and really many ways an expansion of social programs in this nation that we haven't seen since Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society in the 1960s. Forcing debate on the debt ceiling to drag out can go either way. It can push sides to come together. That serves as a focal point for them to make decisions and make deals in a couple months in December, when, with the extension being in place until then. But also it can cause distraction to be, to take attention away from those other initiatives of the Biden administration toward just trying to get through the debt ceiling and averting that crisis.
Now, one of the terminologies we hear being thrown around, or that was thrown around in the past couple of days, was this term stopgap measure. What is that? Explain to that to our listeners and how that works.
Stopgap measure, I think in terms of what you're discussing, is that the agreement that was reached by the House and the Senate last week to extend the debt ceiling by, sounds like a lot of money, but in terms of the federal debt and the federal budget, a couple hundred billion is a lot of money, but it's not a lot compared to the overall federal budget. But to extend the federal debt by a couple hundred billion for just a few months, that stopgap decision to kick the can down the road just for a few months. And in many ways, that's what the federal government does in terms of its budgeting decisions in general. The federal government rarely passes a comprehensive federal budget on time every year.
Dr. William Hatcher is the interim chair of the Department of Social Sciences and an associate professor of political science at Augusta University in Georgia. Voice of America! You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. President Joe Biden on Wednesday announced a plan to clear the backlog of container ships off the coast of Southern California by launching 24-hour operations at the Port of Los Angeles. American retailers and manufacturers have been plagued with shortages. And as Mike Sullivan reports, the backlog highlights problems that have disrupted global supply chains.
Ships waiting weeks off the coast, while U.S. demand for imported goods and components from Asia soars as the nation struggles to emerge from the pandemic. Gene Soroka is executive director of the Port of Los Angeles.
Asian factories are at recorded highs in orders, but still behind the production needs of our American importers. In our industry, we've added 30% vessel capacity in the Trans-Pacific trade, and we're still leaving cargo behind.
As China struggles with power outages and Chinese factories attempt to meet demand, a bottleneck in the Pacific. Nearly 30 container ships were berthed Tuesday off the coast of Southern California. Double that number were waiting, either anchored or drifting offshore. It's a problem for Golden Grove Trading, a California company that customizes clothes and novelties from Asia. Shipping costs have soared as consumers buy products for the year-end holidays. Young Schultz is founder and CEO of Golden Grove Trading.
If we ship a 40-foot container from Shanghai to Long Beach, the cost is $2,500. And today it's $16,000, $17,000, $18,000.
Offloading and transit now take weeks instead of days at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, crucial hubs for the U.S. economy. Stephen Chung is chief operating officer of the Los Angeles County Economic Development Corporation and president of World Trade Center Los Angeles.
These two ports control over 40% of all cargo coming in by sea to the United States.
Warehouses are full, rail lines are clogged, and there are not enough truck drivers amid COVID disruptions. And the problem is national. Gene Soroka of the Port of Los Angeles.
A lot of the spotlight has been on the ports here in Southern California because we're the biggest gateway. But Seattle, Tacoma, Oakland, Savannah are all seeing a lot of cargo and ships waiting to get in and out of their ports as well.
Logistics need to be improved, says Young Schultz of Golden Grove Trading.
I don't think, you know, with a single business able to do much. It's really, we need the government help. We need everybody's help.
President Joe Biden is wrangling with Congress over infrastructure funding, including for upgrades to port facilities. He says Walmart is among the retailers that have agreed to move cargo in off-peak hours. Many international ports are active around the clock. That and better coordination along the U.S. supply chain will speed the flow of cargo through California, analysts say. Government and business need to cooperate on a plan, says an expert on the global supply chain. Christopher Tang is a business and management professor at UCLA.
We need to address the following question. Are we going to rely on imports in the future? For how long? The volume? Such that we have a better understanding? Or are we going to reshore some of the supply chain back to the United States or connect to Mexico or Canada? That would be another thing. So once we understand that, then we can develop the better infrastructure to support the plan.
He says working through the backlog off the coast is the first step. Step two, rebuilding the infrastructure to match the future needs of the U.S. economy. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
At least five people were killed and 16 others were wounded as shots were fired during a protest by Iran-backed Hezbollah supporters against Tarek Bitar, the judge investigating the 2020 Beirut port blast. Explosions were also heard Thursday as tensions over the politically charged case push Lebanon into another crisis. The Lebanese army is searching for the gunmen. And for VOA, Del Gavlak reports from Amman.
Interior Minister Bassem Malawi pointed to a worrying development, saying many of the casualties from the eruption of gunfire in Beirut were by snipers from the buildings. This is a very dangerous sign, Malawi told reporters. No one can take this. Joseph Bahut directs the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut and lives near the scene of the shootings. He tells VOA that the bursts of gunfire and the wail of ambulance sirens made him feel like he was reliving scenes from Lebanon's civil war of 1975 to 1990.
Today, it's probably a very explosive situation. The country is now on the verge of maybe something very grave. If really what we hear so far is confirmed that there are snipers on the rooftops that are shooting at both parties protesting in the street, this could really resemble the start of 75 in Lebanon.
At a nearby school, teachers instructed students to lie face down on the ground with their hands on their heads, a witness told Reuters. Bahut warned that the violence, which broke out in an area dividing Christian and Shiite Muslim neighborhoods, a former front line of the 1975 to 1990 civil war, could sideline the probe into last year's catastrophic Beirut port blast that left more than 200 dead and destroyed vast parts of the capital.
We are on a very slippy terrain. And my fear is that the issue of the port inquiry will become soon one of many other crises in the country. This question will become very unfortunately concealed and secondary compared to what is happening since this morning in the streets of Beirut. The clashes, the firing, the sniping. Increasingly, the debate will shift to what happened this morning, who started the shooting, who shot whom. I fear the issue of the port will soon be, in a way, submerged and maybe aside.
Judge Tarek Bitar has faced enormous pressure from former ministers linked to Hezbollah, Lebanon's power broker, and from its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, who accuse him of singling out their political allies for questioning in the probe. They have been trying to stop his investigation into the August 4, 2020 Beirut port blast, one of the biggest non-nuclear explosions in history. Reports said a huge quantity of ammonium nitrate, commonly used to make fertilizer or bombs, was left unsafely stored there for years. Families of the port blast victims have warned against replacing or intimidating Batar, no matter how high the threat level, telling officials to keep their hands off the judiciary. Analyst Joseph Bahut says Prime Minister Najib Makati's new government now faces a fresh sectarian challenge on top of trying to rescue the country from economic collapse and an energy crisis. Some political leaders say that an international investigation into the blast may be needed because Hezbollah is threatened by a probe pointing at it. Del Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
And reporter George Eid in Beirut says that protesters were rallying against Judge Tariq Bitar, who is investigating the massive explosion at Beirut port.
The clashes broke out during a demonstration between Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed militia, and Amal, a political party affiliated to the head of parliament in Lebanon. The clashes turned Beirut's southern edge and suburbs into a war zone. The military deployed tanks and troops to quell the street battles, in which the sound of automatic gunfire and grenade explosions mixed with the wail of ambulance sirens. Samir Jaim, a young Lebanese who works in Beirut, says he was shocked from what happened.
It's really sad what we are going through today. It's like maybe a starting of a new internal war. Hopefully not. Civil armed are everywhere in Beirut. Human losses in road. People are dying in their houses, in their bed. Many children are afraid in their school. I think it's enough for Lebanon. Maybe we need an external support from other countries.
Leah Boudoumet, a university student, was attending her classes when the clashes began. She says she fears a civil war in the country.
The clash that we witnessed today in Lebanon from early hours in the morning, it was kind of expected since last night. But what was not expected was the use of heavy weapons such as B7s, snipers. And it's important to shed the light on now, after this clash, how weak the country is, how the weakness that is in the state institution and the state itself, that they have no control over weaponized militia, technically, in Lebanon, and is putting everyone at risk.
A resident of Romania, the area around which the clashes occurred, said to local media that the unrest started after supporters of the two parties shouted provocations and hurled stones at young men in the area, prompting them to respond in kind. The standoff later escalated into armed clashes between the two parties, with Hezbollah and Emel accusing the Lebanese Forces Party of deploying gunmen on rooftops and opening fire on their peaceful protest. George Gura, a local journalist and political analyst, explains that this was the result of continuous provocations.
He says that what happened today was due to the continuous provocations by Hezbollah. It had entered neighborhoods in the morning where it was not welcome, and it had provoked people. This prompted the Lebanese Forces Party to open fire. And mainly due to the fact that most of the political parties in Lebanon are armed, we saw what we saw today. However, international intervention was the main reason. Everything was contained in a fast way, and we saw things calm down eventually.
The protesters were rallying against Judge Tariq Bitar, tasked with investigating the massive explosion at Beirut port, which killed more than 200 people and destroyed parts of the capital on August 4th last year. The judge had in recent days been in the sights of Hezbollah and Emel in particular for insisting on a subpoena for top officials in his probe into the Beirut port explosion. This is George Aid, reporting for VOA from Beirut.
At a news conference in Beirut, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland says that Lebanon needs an impartial judiciary, an apparent criticism of Hezbollah, which has been demanding the removal of the judge leading the investigation into last year's massive port explosion.
A clean, impartial, independent judiciary is the guarantor of all the rights and the values that we as democracies hold dear and share. Again, the Lebanese people deserve no less, and the victims and families of those lost in the port blast deserve no less.
U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland. In other news, President Joe Biden told visiting Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on Thursday that the United States will make a one-time donation of more than 17 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to the African Union. The meeting with Kenyatta at the White House marked Biden's first as president with an African leader. Kenya holds the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council this month. And a panel of expert advisors to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration unanimously voted on Thursday to recommend booster shots of Moderna COVID-19 vaccine for Americans aged 65 and older and those at high risk of severe illness. And for more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. The International Court of Justice this week drew a maritime borderline between Somalia and Kenya following 7 years of legal battles. The dispute contributed to the deterioration of the relations between the two neighboring countries. Although the court awarded Somalia the largest share of a disputed maritime area in the Indian Ocean, it also adjusted the new borderline, which favored Kenya. Paul Reschler is one of the maritime lawyers who defended Somalia's case at the ICJ. And in this interview with VOA's Harun Maruf, he deconstructs details about how the ruling by the court affects the maritime borders, boundaries of the two countries.
Well, this is a very favorable result for Somalia in a number of significant respects. First of all, it establishes a definitive maritime boundary between Somalia and Kenya, and thus ends a long-standing dispute over where the boundary is, because the court's judgment is final and binding on both states as a matter of international law. Second, the boundary is that the court drew is very close to the line for which Somalia advocated. The court accepted Somalia's approach that the boundary should be based on an equidistance line that follows a southeasterly direction from the coast. The court did make an adjustment of that line slightly in Kenya's favor, so that in the court's view, the result would be more equitable to both parties. And three, the adjustment that was made by the court, which benefits Kenya, demonstrates, if anything, the degree to which the court made every effort to be fair to both parties. And that makes the judgment all the more credible and really bulletproof to any kind of attack that Kenya might make for political reasons.
I saw the line drawn by the court, the professional equidistance line. And based on the Somalia line and the Kenya line, it appears the court struck down the middle, almost close to 50-50.
That's not right. We've measured it. And 75% of the disputed area goes to Somalia, 25% goes to Kenya. And I could give you the exact measurements. In the territorial sea, that is the first 12 miles, the court used an equidistance approach so that it's basically Somalia got 100% of the disputed area in the territorial sea. That's the first 12 miles from the coast. In the area beyond the territorial sea, what's called the exclusive economic zone or the continental shelf, that is the area between 12 and 200 miles, Somalia got 75% of the disputed area and Kenya 25%.
What about the continental shelf?
Well, the continental shelf and the exclusive economic zone go together within 200 miles. In the area beyond 200 miles, up to 350 miles, the boundary will follow that same line, that same angle, all the way out to the 350-mile limit. And here, we can say that in this area beyond 200 miles of the portion of that area that is disputed, Somalia gets 2/3 of it and Kenya 1/3.
That was Paul Reschler, one of the maritime lawyers who defended Somalia's case at the ICJ. He was speaking to VOA's Harun Maruf. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very great weekend.